Hi, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for GSE-registered optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This month, we're diving into binocular vision. When we talk about BV issues, we're normally thinking about the paediatric cohort. But there are also many thousands of adults across the UK who have developed double vision later in life. Many of them really struggle with their eyesight, and therefore they struggle with daily activities. With the right knowledge, though, optometrists can take the first steps to improve the lives of these patients. It's just a question of knowing what to do and when to do it. In other words, when to monitor, manage, or refer. If we can start to pinpoint the cause of their double vision, we can ensure that our patients end up on the right pathway to restore their vision and their quality of life. Nadeem Ali, a consultant ophthalmologist who's been dealing with BV issues for 25 years, will take us through that process.
Among a lot of optometrists, there's a kind of fear or uncertainty when it comes to BV in adults. I mean, of all the other things that optoms are doing, I really don't think that BV or double vision should be considered one of the harder things. The most important thing for an optometrist is to work out what causes of double vision are potentially serious and what aren't.
But first, we're going to hear from Pauline Brand, a retired healthcare worker. In 2016, Pauline noticed something change in her vision. She told Dr. Hilary Guite, one of our producers, all about it.
Driving to Milton Keynes one day, I suddenly noticed that the car in front had another car exactly like it alongside. So I had a quick blink, rubbed my eyes thinking the contacts had slipped. It disappeared and that was fine. But then gradually over the next weeks and months, I noticed that this was happening more and more. And it also got to the point when watching television, I was seeing double images there and I was resorting to the covering up one of my eyes.
And then what happened next?
Well, this went on for a little while and I mentioned it to Vision Express. They suggested that I should be referred to the GP just to check out what was happening to exclude any diseases. Basically, I saw the consultant with the NHS. He was very upset because they'd sent me to him without being sent to an orthoptist first. And the thought of having to wait another 5 months was not something I felt I could deal with. So I had an appointment at a private eye hospital within a week and they determined it was just a straightforward double vision. Blood test I'd had before ruled out anything else. So the orthoptist then fitted the plastic prism and it was like magic. And of course, they did warn me that I'm going to need stronger prisms in the future.
So the optometrist in the hospital reviewed you every how often?
Annually.
Annually, and each time they increased the prescription on your prism?
Yeah, it was just getting worse. But now I had an eye that had a squint that, you know, I was finding that sometimes the prism didn't help.
So tell me about the squint.
Well, it became noticeable to me. I was feeling really self-conscious about it. And that's why over the contact lens glasses that were sunglasses were a saviour, because during the summer, I never took them off. I always wore them. You know, I went inside wearing my sunglasses because it would hide my eye. So you start doing all these avoidance techniques.
So you were wearing sunglasses in summer. What else were you doing to avoid people seeing?
Oh, the hair. I'd have my hair so it would hang over the eye a bit more. Photographs, I wouldn't do a face on because all I can see is this squinty eye. So I think I'm starting to think, because this is years gone on now, maybe I need to think about having something done.
So how did you find your way to surgical treatment?
So I did start researching on Dr. Google, of course, but the London Squint Clinic came up quite frequently. I think within a week, I had a video consultation with Mr. Ali.
And so what surgery did you have?
So it's strabismus surgery. It was to correct the squint, realign the eye, which would get rid of the double vision.
And how was it?
It was incredible. It was magic. I mean, I had some Oromorph because Mr. Ali was going to do the stitch adjustment on the outside of the eye. And then he did the test with the pen, follow this pen with your eyes, and a point just to the side, and suddenly I could see two pens. And he said, right, okay. And he adjusted the stitch. You didn't feel a thing. And did the same test again, and now I only see a single pen.
No double vision.
No double vision.
Did you have any pain or discomfort?
No, I didn't need any pain relief. And we just followed the eye drop regime absolutely to the letter.
So it took, it seems to me, 9 years from when you first had double vision to having it corrected. What advice would you give to other patients?
Don't be as stupid as me.
Oh.
Go and get it done. You know, my husband said, you just look happier. And I said, I just feel me again. It's just been totally life-changing.
Pauline Brand, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
You're welcome.
As you just heard, Pauline ended up having surgery with Mr. Nadeem Ali at the London Squint Clinic. Nadeem is with me now. So, Nadeem, hello. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Michelle. Pleasure to be here.
So, Nadeem, we just heard from Pauline, who was eventually one of your patients. Did her story surprise you when you came across it?
I wouldn't say it surprised me. It's quite a common story that we hear from the patients who come to us. They often come to us once they've been through quite a long journey. We have people who've been given prism for 20 years, gradually increasing over the years, and nobody's ever mentioned the fact that surgery was another option.
And looking at this area of eye care more broadly, we usually talk about binocular vision issues with children. So what's different about the adult cohort, do you think?
Obviously, binocular vision issues in children is very common. They say up to 5% of people have a squint of some sort, and there are very well established management pathways. The main difference from a kind of clinical point of view is that children, of course, don't get double vision because their brain is adapting and learns to suppress the image from the misaligned eye. Whereas with adults, those mechanisms have switched off, and therefore when they get misalignment, they present with double vision normally.
And in terms of how we manage binocular vision with adults, what do you think we generally misunderstand about managing these patients?
I think that's a really good question. I've picked up among a lot of optometrists, there's a kind of fear or uncertainty when it comes to BV in adults. And I think the first thing I want to say is it's really not that hard. I mean, of all the other things that optoms are doing, I really don't think that BV or double vision should be considered one of the harder things. The second thing is that the most important thing for an optometrist is to work out what causes of double vision are potentially serious and what aren't. The ones which are potentially serious cannot be managed in community optometry. They have to be sent to the hospital. The ones which are not serious can, of course, be managed initially, at least, in community optometry. So separating that into the two categories is the main task. And the final thing, which is, I'd say, the bane of my life, is that people are given prism for far too long or inappropriately. As a general rule, knowing when to give prism and when prism is no longer suitable is a really important thing to understand.
And of course, you talk about the duration of patients using prism. So the reluctance for optometrists to take any action sooner might be because they feel that actually because the prism amount is increasing, they feel that the condition is not stable enough in terms of, you know, potentially having surgery.
The main reason why the prism goes up is because it was never enough in the first place. I very often see patients who have 4 prism diopters in their glasses, but when we measure it, it's 16 or 20.
Mm.
Now, you can imagine that if their actual angle is 16 or 20, and you started with 4, then next year you're going to give 6, and the following year you're going to give 8, you're just kind of catching up. That doesn't mean the thing itself is unstable.
Right.
And that's the commonest cause I see of increasing prism. Not lack of stability, just underdosing from the start. And the second thing is they can have surgery, and often it's actually a better solution in those cases in particular. I mean, you know, it's just part of general clinical care is that you discuss all the options. I'll always mention doing nothing, having prism, having Botox, or finally surgery.
So let's move on to potential causes and mechanisms. So looking at how optometrists deal with patients in practice, I recently had a patient who was having trouble with his spectacles. He was a fairly new presbyope, and it turned out that it wasn't actually his vision that was blurred. It turned out he had mild double vision. And when I asked him about it more, he said, well, actually, when I say it's blurred, I feel like I've got an extra image. And I asked him if it was an image slightly to the side, where it's like an extra image just partly overlapping, or was it actually two separate images, and were they side by side? He said, no, they're at a diagonal. And that's when I asked him about trauma. And he was a footballer who had headed the ball quite a lot, and he'd had a couple of concussions. He'd had a previous broken nose. So I think he's probably had a bit of rough and tumble with his football. So that's something that, you know, you could come across in practice quite easily, I think, where patients don't really present and say, I've got double vision. So those are things I asked at the time. But what are the key things that you think optometrists should ask in history of symptoms?
Well, first of all, I'll say I have done a 20-point checklist for optometry, which goes through all of these things, what you need to ask and what you need to test. But the first thing to think of is, before you even start asking the questions, is just pause for a moment and think, what age person have I got in front of me? Then the second thing is onset. If the patient can say, I was doing this and it suddenly went double, I was driving and it suddenly went double, I was watching TV and it suddenly went double, that's acute onset, and that is now raising alarm bells. Whereas if they can't date the onset, you say, how long has it been like this? They go, oh, it's been a good while now. Well, a few weeks, a few months, oh, quite a long time. You know, they can't date it. Mm. That is much more likely to be decompensation of something longstanding rather than a new acute event. The next thing, like you asked, is to describe the double vision. Is it side by side? Is it one above the other? Is it side by side and one above the other, which is kind of oblique in some way? And finally, one which is often not asked about is one of them tilted or slanted or at an angle? Because torsional double vision, of course, is something that most optometrists don't have the facility to pick up unless they're doing double Maddox rods, which not all of them are doing. And certainly it's not correctable by prism. And then another thing that's really useful is to say, what's it worse for? Is it worse for distance or is it worse for close-up? You know, worse for close-up, we've got kind of convergence weakness type problems. Worse for distance, you've got like divergence weakness or sixth nerve palsies, things like that. Is it worse to right or left? Now talking about incompetence horizontally, thinking about things like fourth nerve palsies and so on. And then the final kind of general question about the double vision is, how is it changing? Is it getting worse? Is it getting worse rapidly? Has it stayed the same since onset?
Okay, so we've asked the patient about the double vision and the nature of their double vision. Are there any other symptoms that we need to ask them about that might give a clue as to the cause and whether or not they're red flags that we need to be aware of?
So I think you have to have a couple of checklists which are to exclude serious causes. So the first one is a general neurological kind of symptom checklist. So things like headache, pain, weakness in an arm, leg. You don't want to be picking up double vision and miss the fact that they've got a weak arm or leg and they've had a stroke. Speech problems, vertigo, tinnitus, any blackout, nausea, vomiting, and whether they've had any MS, multiple sclerosis. New double vision in a patient with MS completely is a different kettle of fish to if they don't have MS. And then secondly, because this is so often missed, you should have a checklist for myasthenia gravis. Now, myasthenia gravis is a rare condition, and if untreated, can be really, really serious. So some of the questions you want to ask are, do you have the symptoms when you wake up or not? Because in myasthenia, when you wake up, there's no double vision, generally. And then after about 5-10 minutes, you start getting the double vision. Do you have droopy eyelids, you know, ptosis, especially that comes on over the course of the day? Have you got any speech, swallowing or breathing problems? Myasthenia can spread and affect the muscles of the throat and the chest, and then just general muscle weakness. So once you've done that, you can confidently say there are no other symptoms suggestive of myasthenia. And then a couple of just general medical history questions, which you'd probably do anyway, but just a bit more focused. Have they had any cancer? That's really important. You know, in anyone who's had cancer in the past, a new onset of double vision, we're a bit more worried about. Could this be a recurrence of cancer, metastasis, something like that? Have they had thyroid problems? That's obviously a well-known one because you have thyroid eye disease and double vision. And then, of course, things like cardiovascular risk factors, specifically your blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, heart attack, stroke, and things like that, because there's so many causes of double vision which are essentially like mini strokes or things like that. And the final set of questions to ask, and I can see this is more than your normal quick appointment, but the final question on this is, did they have a childhood squint? If they had a childhood squint, they were patched, they had surgery, it now changes things when a squint comes back later. Obviously, it's less likely they should present with double vision, but they can certainly present with a decompensation of something later.
I think it would be really good to have a copy of your 20-point checklist, and we could put that on the docket website for optometrists to refer to. So if we move on to the investigations that we might do in our consulting rooms, what do you think we should be doing next?
Okay, so pupils, obviously, I think everyone checks their pupils all the time. What you're looking for there is a blown pupil or an enlarged pupil, which is a characteristic of a third nerve palsy. You won't find that on its own. It'll be with normally ptosis and some limitation of eye movements. So the pupil doesn't react to light. Eyelids, obviously ptosis is one. You can get ptosis in myasthenia. You can get ptosis in a third nerve palsy. But also you need to think about thyroid eye disease with maybe lid swelling or lid retraction. And then proptosis, not that common. But if you have orbital inflammation, orbital cellulitis, something like that, you can get acute double vision and proptosis. Or if you've got a mass behind the eye, a tumor of some sort, that's going to give you double vision with swelling, proptosis. And then the discs. There are some causes of double vision which are due to something going on in the brain, which will also have raised intracranial pressure, and therefore you want to document whether the discs are flat, which you would have done anyway. But the point is, you're thinking, I'm going to look for swelling of the disc. I'm going to exclude disc swelling in this case.
So, Nadine, when a patient comes in with double vision, what further investigations should we be doing?
Really, really simple. To determine whether someone has serious cause of double vision, you only need to test one thing, and that is ductions. And what we mean by ductions is that one eye is covered, and then you test the other eye can go into all the different extremes of gaze, left, right, up, down. And if you want to do the corners, that's fine. But even those four will normally be enough. So it's making sure that the eye can reach the corners. If it can't reach the outside corner, there's a problem with abduction. You're thinking of something serious like a sixth nerve palsy. That's not a childhood squint or something that's just decompensated. That's now serious. If the eye doesn't go in or down or up, that's a sign of a weakness of the medial rectus, inferior rectus, superior rectus, and something like a third nerve palsy. So you just do that for each eye. Ductions. You can do your normal tests as well with both eyes open. You can do a cover test. That's all fine. But they are not going to distinguish serious from non-serious causes. It's ductions that is the most important thing. And I don't know, do optometrists do that normally as part of their exam?
No, I was going to say we always do it binocularly and we look at the behaviours of both eyes. So if someone appears to have a restriction in one direction of gaze, we're looking actually, is there restriction in the other eye or not?
You should do that as part of every examination. Mm. You should do both eyes together. But say if you're moving a target over to the right and both eyes stop. Which eye is the cause of that stopping? Mm. You don't know. So that's when you need to then cover an eye and see, okay, is it the left eye not moving into the nose, or is it the right eye not moving out to the ear? You know, so it's that extra step that's really important. And it's the limitation of eye movements is the key sign.
Yeah.
While you're there, the other thing you're going to do, which we could have done earlier, is just to check that it's definitely binocular double vision and not monocular double vision or ghosting.
Yeah. So how do we differentiate between a binocular vision problem or a double vision that's caused by, say, a natural part of aging or something that's more sinister?
So now you're talking about a patient maybe over 70 years old who has double vision. And the classic differentiation is between a sixth nerve palsy, which is not that uncommon in elderly people with cardiovascular risk factors, and an age-related distance esotropia, which is like a divergence weakness. Their lateral recti just don't pull as hard and therefore they get a bit of an esotropia for distance. Well, two things. Out of all the things we've asked, the things that are going to stand out are, number one, a sixth nerve palsy will present acutely. They'll remember the day it started. Okay, whereas a kind of age-related weakness is going to come on very gradually and they won't be able to pin it down to a particular day. The second thing is, when you test ductions, you will find with a sixth nerve palsy that the lateral rectus doesn't work fully. The eye will stop before it looks out fully. Whereas with an age-related thing, it'll reach just about the end. There'll hardly be any limitation there. So just those two things out of our checklist will allow you to distinguish whether it's age-related or whether it's a sixth nerve palsy. Now, the interesting thing is, in both cases, you're going to refer.
Yes.
But the urgency of that referral, that's going to differ. If I was an optometrist, I had double vision, and I didn't think it was serious, I would let the person receiving it and triaging the referral make that decision. So I would say, could you please see this 72-year-old lady with gradual onset, horizontal double vision, and full eye movements, full stop? I would like to exclude a age-related problem or exclude a sixth nerve palsy, whatever you want. If you feel it should be urgent, definitely say it should be urgent. Hospitals have a whole profession dedicated to the assessment of double vision. It's called orthoptics. Why not use them when you've got acute double vision? Acute double vision is the one thing where you really feel, why not let the specialists have a look at it?
And I suppose the other thing as well is about the referral is if you do suspect a microvascular accident, such as a microaneurysm from diabetes, is it best to refer to the GP and to the hospital eye service at the same time? So you're doing a dual referral almost.
I would definitely refer to the hospital eye department and not to the GP. Because the problem with dual referrals is, where does the responsibility lie? So keep it simple, keep it direct, keep it mono-channel and get it into the eye department. They will do the blood pressure, they'll do the blood tests. They'll do tests which the GP may not think of, such as ESR and CRP to exclude giant cell arteritis, which is a rare cause of double vision. And they'll get assessed by the orthoptics. And then they'll refer back to the GP or to acute medicine, or they'll get them admitted under the stroke team. Whatever it is, I think that's the right place to do it.
And supposing we've examined a patient in practice and we've decided that actually their double vision is gradual onset, they're perfectly healthy, we're not worried about anything sinister. It doesn't require any medical intervention. So what are the next steps in managing that patient? So I'm thinking about, when do we decide, should we try some exercises or do we just go straight into prescribing prison?
So I'll say something here, which I don't know how popular it'll be. I still think that patient should be referred to orthoptics. Because most of the time, when people are given PRISM, it's without a diagnosis. So I would still say they should be seen non-urgently, in this case, by orthoptics. Get your diagnosis. They'll come back to you again. They don't want to keep seeing them in hospital forever. And then you can give your PRISM. Or you can give them your PRISM while they're waiting for their appointment. So now we're into giving them some PRISM. PRISM is the right option for many, many patients. It'll solve their problems. And they will get years and years, or maybe their whole life, of benefit with two diopters, four diopters, whatever, of PRISM in it. So go for it.
So do you think the key to understanding that patient who will be happy with a few diopters of PRISM, probably for the rest of their life, versus someone who is going to have a PRISM, and because it hasn't been assessed fully, they're just going to PRISM adapt and going to need more and more and more as time goes on. So how to differentiate between those two types of patients?
Well, that's going to come from monitoring them. You won't know that at the first assessment. So you're going to see them in 6 months and recheck and ask them their symptoms and remeasure it at that point. All I'm saying is that if you find that they're getting to higher prisms, so certainly anything over 10 horizontally or over 5 vertically, now's the time to think about surgery. And the reason is that prism is good, but it's not great. Okay, there's lots of downsides to prism which aren't talked about. So you get distortion, you get jack-in-the-box effect where things just pop in from the side, you get blind spots, people find it quite disorienting, turning their heads and looking and moving around, doing sport with prism glasses. Have you ever tried to play tennis with prism glasses? It's not easy.
I was going to say, it sounds like it might be quite tricky.
Yeah, and then of course there's the weight of them as well. So I think it's more about just thinking, what is in the patient's best interest? What would I want my mum or dad to be doing? And of course, it's that category of people, like as you're saying, that the prisms correct their double vision, but they would love to be out of prisms. And they are the contact lens we're wearing myopes. They start to develop something called a myopic esotropia with double vision for distance in their 40s, 50s, 60s. And then they get a bit of prism from the opticians and it helps for a while. It keeps increasing. But they would love to go back to contact lenses again because they never liked glasses in the first place. Those are some of the happiest patients when they have surgery.
So what kind of patients might be eligible for squint surgery on the NHS? So, for example, in some areas, squint vision may be classed as a low clinical priority because the patient can still see.
Let's just clarify this. Almost everywhere in the country, you have access to adult strabismus surgery on the NHS. The issue you raise is about what they call cosmetic squints, not double vision. They're talking about squints without double vision. The ones which are generally childhood squints, which have come back in later life. They've got an exotropia, esotropia. The appearance is affecting their lives. It has big psychosocial impact. It is an important condition and it has functional benefits to do the surgery, but it's not giving them double vision. That's where some trusts have said, we're not going to do that. But it's only a minority. Most trusts are still operating on those as well. They may have thresholds, like they only do it above a certain angle or whatever. But double vision is different. Now, double vision is operated on the NHS, and you can get surgery for double vision if you want it.
And we all know the story about NHS waiting times and the pressure that the NHS is on. So when a patient doesn't want to wait, as in Pauline's case, she didn't want to wait a long time to be seen by an orthoptist and then wait to see an NHS consultant. If a patient wants to consider being seen by a private clinic, it may be quite different to what, you know, we don't really know what they involve. So can you talk through what you might cover at an initial consultation that we haven't already covered in the optometrist examination?
Nothing special is the answer. They'll see an orthoptist, get a very detailed orthoptic examination, which is what they really need. But that won't be any different to the orthoptic examination that the same orthoptist would do on the NHS. You know, it's just a complete orthoptic examination.
Mm.
The reason why people go private is two reasons. One is to cut out the wait, and the other is because they want to pick a certain person to do their surgery.
And from your point of view, what do you take into account when planning surgery on patients?
So the main thing I take into account is what are the problems they have in their daily life, which I want to help with. From the problems, you then link that to what findings on examination link to those problems. Like, for example, they're having problems playing squash and you measure a certain type of squint or misalignment in different angles. You have to know which bits of that are relevant to them playing squash. Same with somebody on a computer. So that's the first thing. The second thing is what muscles can I move or alter or strengthen or weaken to correct that? And once I've established that, that's a kind of surgical plan. That's really where the expertise comes in, actually.
Mm. And in the planning, I mean, you mentioned Botox earlier. You don't always just go straight in and do surgery, do you?
So Botox is an alternative to surgery or sometimes used as a precursor to surgery.
Mm.
So when it's used as an alternative to surgery, that normally is where people either do not want surgery at all or they can't have surgery for whatever reason. Now, the way Botox works is it paralyzes a muscle. So it gets weaker, and therefore you get a change in the angle of the eye. Initially, it completely paralyzes it, so you get a bit of an overcorrection, and then about a week or so later, it kind of settles down, straightens up, and then your eye goes straight normally for a few months, 2 to 3, 3 to 4, something like that, and then it wears off. And then if you want to use that as a long-term treatment, you're going to have that again and again and again. You're right. Sometimes Botox is used as a diagnostic test to see whether someone will get double vision when their eyes are made straighter. So it's like a precursor to surgery.
Mm.
I do that occasionally, but rarely. And the reason for that is because I use adjustable stitches for almost all of my adult squints, which there's a risk of double vision. And that means I can do a double vision test in real life on the day of the operation. So they have their surgery, we move the muscles, we use adjustable stitches, which means that once they are awake, watching TV, you know, walking around, we can see, are they getting double? And then we can adjust it till we get single then. So it's less of a worry when you have the option to adjust it after the surgery.
So just to wrap things up, what are the key things you want optometrists to take away from this podcast? What do you want them to hear and think, right, I can do that differently today?
With a checklist of important symptoms, you can sort double vision into serious or non-serious. Number two, learn how to test ductions. That's measurement of eye movements in one eye, checking it goes all the way to the extremes. And if it doesn't, then you've got a limitation, that's a sign of something serious. And number three, remember that PRISM is great for many patients, but surgery is better for a lot of them as well. And don't be afraid to refer them for surgery, which will benefit them, and they are the most grateful patients to the optometrists who refer them for surgery. The pleasure you get from a returning patient after they've had successful double vision surgery is more than the pleasure you'll get from giving them prism glasses.
So prism isn't the only way.
Correct.
Well, Nadine, they're great tips, so thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much for having me, Michelle.
And thank you for listening. Don't forget that if you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. Also, if you've got a topic in mind that you'd like us to cover, you can email us on podcast@docket.info or use LinkedIn to send us a message. There's a link in the podcast description. By completing the short exercise on our website for this episode, you can gain one CPD point covering clinical practice. We'll be back again next month, so make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so that you don't miss out. But that's all from us for now. The producers are Jason Hoskin and Dr. Hilary Guite. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.